2011 ended in Russia with a perfect storm that turned the country's politics on its head. Angered by official corruption and impunity, and sparked into action by widespread allegations of voter fraud in December's parliamentary elections, civil society woke up from its long slumber and found its voice, powered by a newly politically conscious urban middle class. The increased wealth and confidence of the urban professional class, its newfound ability to organize over the internet, and a global atmosphere of protest that sparked the Arab Spring uprisings in the Middle East and the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States also contributed to a combustible mix. Adding to the general zeitgeist of change, splits are becoming increasingly apparent among the ruling elite, which appears more divided than any time in recent history about the country's political direction. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. My guest in the studio today is longtime Russia watcher Mark Galeotti, professor of global affairs at New York University, author of numerous books on Russia, and author of the column Siloviks and Scoundrels, which is published in the newspaper The Moscow News. Welcome, Mark.
Good to be here.
To start our discussion today, I wanted to play a brief clip from an interview I recently did with Nicholas Gvozdev, a Russia specialist and professor at the U.S. Navy War College, when I asked him if the genie could be put back in the bottle after all that's happened since the December 4th elections. Let's listen to that clip now.
The genie can go partially back in, and the bottle will have to change its shape. You can't force everything back into the pre-2008 mold, because that's where you'll get the explosion. You know, if 2011 is the return of the reawakening of civil society, I mean, the 2012 will be the question of, okay, it woke up, now what? Where does it go from here? Does it go back to sleep? Does it get co-opted? Does it break up? Does it, in fact, create, you know, an irreversible shift that moves things forward?
So playing off of that, Mark, what do you think? I mean, can the genie be put back in the bottle? Does the bottle change its shape? Where does this all go in 2012, in your opinion?
Well, let's play with that metaphor a little bit more. In some ways, the key question is actually how much pressure the genie has. Things can always be pushed back if you're willing to use enough force. Sometimes it's going to break the bottle, sometimes it won't. I think we're at the situation where, and let's face it, this is unknown territory for all of us, where at present the protest movement is not so strong, so irreversible, that it can't be suppressed. That said, suppression would have major, major costs. And therefore, I think it really becomes a cost-benefit analysis within the current Russian elite. Do they think they can just weather this current storm and hope that, in fact, the pressure just dies down and the genie dissipates? Or do they actually think that they really need to try and move quite violently? And so far, at least, the indications are that they are adopting the former approach, whether it's because of a strategy or just a lack of strategy.
Do you think that can work? I mean, they've offered some tepid reforms. I'm not sure how tepid. I mean, it's the devil's going to be in the details. I mean, they've offered the return to the election of governors, although if you look at the fine print on that, it's not really a return to the election of governors as we knew it pre-2004. They've offered to ease the rules of registering political parties and candidates. But again, the problem here has not always been the letter of the law. The problem has always been the execution of the law. And most importantly, a lot of these reforms don't come into effect until after this election cycle, after the 2012 election cycle, and after presumably Putin is safely embedded in the Kremlin again for a six-year term this time. So do you think these reforms they're offering are enough to kind of muddle through?
Well, I think in and of themselves the reforms aren't, because exactly, they are predicated upon an assumption that you can tell those elements of Russian society that are angry and disappointed and disaffected, trust us, we will bring out some really great reforms once we're through this election cycle, once you've handed power back to us. Those people who are mistrustful of the Kremlin aren't going to believe it. And those people who don't really care about these reforms, well, that's not in their agenda anyway. So, I mean, I think really, in some ways, these reforms, they're important for two reasons. Firstly, because they possibly map out some of the ways in which Putin is willing to see the political system change. And yeah, absolutely. Anyway, it's never been really about the formal structures of power, but about actually how power really works. So, Ben, that's the first thing. It's a sort of a possible guideline for how things might change. The second thing is that it reflects, I think, an awareness on the side of the Kremlin that they had to respond in some way. And I think that is, in some ways, for me, the most interesting thing. that they couldn't just turn round by impugning the patriotism or the morals of the protesters and the protester leaders, that they couldn't just simply ignore it and hope it would all go away, that they knew they had to respond in some kind of a way and make actually what was a concession, which is, I think, again, an important step.
Now, one of the things they appear to be trying to do here is to decouple the mass of the protesters who are, let's face it, by and large, previously apolitical, middle-class, urban professionals, mm-hmm. right, that have been spurred into action by anger about corruption, by and it was sparked by the election result and sparked by the decision in September for Putin to return to the presidency. But they're trying to separate this mass, who they've praised. They've gone out of their way to praise. Remember, Surkov called them the most productive members of our society, while on the other hand, disparaging the traditional opposition leaders, your Boris Nemtsovs, your Yevgeny Chadikovas, and so on and so forth, and to try to split them. Is that a good strategy? I mean, is how much cohesion do you see between the traditional opposition leaders and these new protesters, as it were? And is this strategy to decouple them a good strategy from the Kremlin's point of view?
I think it's a pretty good interim strategy. I think the thing is, actually, we've, if anything, got three separate groupings. There are the traditional, shall we say, protest leaders such as Nemtsov, who frankly are in many ways spent forces, who are happily sort of seeking to rekindle their strength on the basis of this new movement, but actually have relatively little traction and relevance. Then you have the new generation, the Navalny's in particular, you know, sort of, who are currently icons, and I mean that in the sense of, because they are two-dimensional figures more than anything else. And then you have the third, this rather sort of bizarre vanguard of the bourgeoisie, an unusual revolutionary movement of precisely yuppies, middle-class people who up to this point, you know, they haven't suffered under the Putin regime in terms of their
on
material.
The contrary, they've
precisely
done quite well under the Putin regime.
If you look at where people are most miserable, then they're on the whole the most quiet. They've been beaten down. So you have actually three separate elements. Now, at present, they're cohabiting quite effectively. Clearly, the Kremlin is hoping to be able to break those down. Because the key thing is, if the Kremlin can make sure that the Navalny's cannot actually create a mechanism, a movement, a structure, then they can have their periodic rallies and everyone will feel very happy and wave their balloons and their placards and so forth, but it's not going to make any difference to the grand calculus of power in Russia.
In the short term, though, because there's a larger kind of almost sociological issue that's going on right here, and this, I've mentioned this before in this podcast and I've written about it extensively on the blog, and that's that in authoritarian societies that create middle classes, I mean, if you have Chile, South Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, you pick your one. When you create this middle class, when you have an authoritarian system and a relatively free economy, this middle class sooner or later begins to clamor for political rights. And that desire for political rights doesn't go away. It might reach various peaks of intensity like we just saw in December. It might dissipate now as Russia retires for its holiday season, for its month of holiday season. It may or may not come back, you know, in time for the March presidential election. But in general, this desire for political rights is there. And it's not going to go away. So is the Kremlin playing a short-term game here when they're really going to have a long-term problem?
It's completely short-term. If you ask me if in 10 years' time I thought the current system could be in place in Russia, I would say not a chance, precisely for that reason. And I think it is going to be from the middle class that pressure is going to come, pressure that can't be suppressed and can't be ignored. However, to be honest, I don't think anyone in the Kremlin is really thinking of 10 years. We are just talking about they want to know how they can get through the next 3 months. And once they're past the presidential election cycle, then they reckon they have years to try and work it out, or at least to create some new basis on which to sort of be able to manage the process of democratization.
So are they thinking in those? Do you think they're thinking in those terms, the process of democratization?
I think in very, very broad terms, yes. But in terms of really sort of what actually occupies their waking hours, it's the next 3 months, mm-hmm. not the next 3 or 13 years.
What do you see happening in the election? I mean, I know this is prediction is a fool's game in Russia, but what do you see happening there?
It's always a dangerous thing to make these kind of predictions, but here I am. I can't see Putin not winning the election.
I agree.
It's going to go to a second round. But I think, if nothing else, this strategy that is being articulated of ensuring that there's a proliferation of anti-Putin candidates will fragment the vote enough. And the bottom line is that unless you can find a common ground between the communists and the middle-class liberal protesters, that's what you need to bring Putin down, and that's just the one thing I can't see happening.
That. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Not unless, do you see somebody like Prokhorov, who I haven't quite figured out, and I'd like to, your thoughts on this. Is Prokhorov playing his own game now, or is Prokhorov carrying out a mission for the Kremlin?
I would suspect that Prokhorov, like actually so many other actors within the current sort of Russian elite, however we define that, is at once telling the Kremlin that it's playing the Kremlin game, while also keeping one eye on potential end games, potential other outcomes, ways of actually sort of maximizing, leveraging his own sort of power, however that's defined. I certainly don't think that he actually has rolled in, as he has himself proclaimed, as an anti-Kremlin candidate with no connections to the Putin circle, shall we say. I mean, clearly there is some degree of connectivity there. But on the other hand, I think simply to write Prokhorov off as just a complete sort of Kremlin stooge, I think would be a mistake. I think the point is this: everyone is a political entrepreneur in their own right in the current situation, because this is it. No one knows what's going to happen.
Right. Now, you wanted to go back to your point about this long-term process of democratization. There's a factor in this, and it's on one hand, you'd think Putin would see this, and he can go down in history as the one that kind of not only brought stability to Russia, but then knew when it was time to go and democratize the system. But he's not doing that, and there's a reason why I think he's not doing that, and that's because Putin came of age politically in the 1980s. During the perestroika period, and he saw an attempt to reform the system end up bringing down the whole house of cards. And in this sense, Putin kind of has a fear of reform, even though maybe part of him might understand that reform is necessary. And I don't know if there was an interview Kudrin gave to the New York Times months and months ago when the interviewer asked him, does Putin get the need for reform? And Kudrin said something very telling. He's like, he's getting there. He's getting there. So how do you assess this with Putin? Does he have this fear of reform that's going to prevent him from doing anything meaningful and just trying to preserve the current system with just nothing more than window dressing changes around the edge?
I think very much so. I mean, I think it's quite interesting that we're seeing more discussion at the moment about sort of Putin history and how he conceptualizes and uses history. And we can come back to that in a bit. But I mean, in some ways, he's a little bit like Tsar Nicholas I, who was a man who intellectually realised that the task of reforming Russia would require substantial social and economic change. But when it came down to it, on a real visceral level, he feared the results. And he himself, you know, Nicholas I had come to power in the time of the Decembrists. Again, he saw that, as it were, ultimately the biggest threat that had to be dealt with was always the threat of internal division and unrest. And likewise, I think, in a way, for Putin, that trumps everything else. However much intellectually, and let's face it, I mean, he's shrewd, but I don't get the sense that he's a deep thinker. However much Putin might become made aware of the need for some long-term democratization, as soon as it looks as if it's going to be a threat to the stability of the state, then his instincts will always be to slam back into repressive mode.
Yeah, no, that's my instinct as well. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me today is Mark Galeotti, professor of global politics at New York University, longtime Russia watcher and author of numerous books on Russia. Mark, your work focuses quite a bit on the role of the security services in Russian politics. And on one hand, the Siloviki have been rather quiet through this whole post-election protest period. On the other hand, there's been indications that they're not losing their influence in any way, shape, or form. Sergei Ivanov was recently appointed Kremlin chief of staff. Sergei Naryshkin recently became speaker of the State Duma. The Siloviki are still in place, but they've been very, very quiet. What do you make of that?
Well, let's distinguish, I think, between the Siloviki, who have become political leaders now, and, as it were, the security apparatus as a whole. The security apparatus is definitely facing quite in some ways, an existential challenge. They're not quite sure how to respond. And interestingly, they are not getting a strong lead from above. You know, we've seen that in contrast to the sort of the first protests immediately surrounding the elections, that the police have adopted now a much, much more tolerant and, frankly, sort of almost positive approach to the protesters. We haven't seen the Amon, or newly redubbed, going in with their truncheons swinging.
I would say the protesters have been very clever in terms of how they've been treating the police, too, bringing them chocolates and the like when they come to the protests. So
yeah,
it's kind
absolutely.
Of been mutual. There's been a little bit of a love fest there, almost.
But. Yes, and there you go. Love your local Amon. But likewise, I mean, usually we'd have expected by now the FSB, the Federal Security Service, to have been sort of presenting sort of grainy footage of second-rank protest leaders accepting bushels of cash from Western NGOs or similar.
They tried that with Nemtsov.
They tried it with Nemtsov, but then again, Nemtsov, I mean,
it's not exactly
he's not even a
Nemtsov.
Second rank, quite frankly. But the interesting thing was there was very little follow-up.
Because it blew up in their face.
Exactly. I mean, but in the past, I think we would have seen a much, much tougher line. And to be honest, I suspect that the whole Nemtsov thing, it might well not have actually been a sort of a fully, carefully, centrally planned operation. And in part, I think it represents the Kremlin not wanting to go for a rerun of 1905 and create some kind of heavy-handed incident that sort of galvanizes protests.
Ghosts of Bloody Sunday
Precisely.
Weigh on them, yeah.
Exactly. They at least do understand that element of their history. But I think it's also, secondly, that people in the security apparatus, and this is what I'm getting a sense of, in a way that they never have before, are beginning to contemplate what might happen in a post-Putin future. And what I mean by that is they've up to now relied on the fact that they have pretty much total impunity to fill their bank accounts, to carry out their private business, and yes, also to snoop and lean on whatever in the name of the stability of the state. Now they begin to think about a possibility of a future in which there might be lustration courts, there might be legal cases brought, there might be accountants being unleashed upon their bank accounts and such like. And in some ways it's reminiscent of 1991, wherein even within the KGB you had people who were shrewd, amoral pragmatists who realised that it was worth beginning to actually recreate themselves in a mode that they could operate under a Yeltsin regime, just in case the Soviet Union was going to collapse. But on the other hand, without burning their bridges. So I think we're beginning to see that. We're actually beginning to see people within the security apparatus wanting to make sure that they don't go too far and create a situation in which they couldn't possibly survive.
Now, a key difference, though, in 1991, you did have a clear alternative, and that was Boris Yeltsin. Right now, you don't really have a clear alternative. So, does that make that calculus a lot more risky on the part of the people in the KGB, in the FSB? There,
well, what it means is that instead of, as it were, aligning themselves with a particular figure, you know, you don't have any lieutenant generals of the FSB ringing up Navalny and saying, "Let me head your security
exactly.
detail." Instead, it's much more of a case of, for example, people are no longer willing to act unless they have written authorizations. That was always one of the interesting things. I mean, just as in the Soviet era, almost all the most politically problematic instructions were handled out on a purely oral level. Mm. Now you're actually getting to the point where people are saying, well, you know, I will require the full proper paperwork for everything. Precisely, so, you know, in due course, you could say, I was only obeying orders and hoping that defence will get you by. But also just generally, people, you might say, who in the past perhaps would have taken much more initiative about whether it's, you know, investigating or actually interfering with the activities of protesters, now just simply sitting back and just simply doing their job. Until they get some sense of either it'll be dangerous from the point of view of, you know, the Kremlin will lean on you if you don't act, or dangerous because the protesters are going to be the new government, I think they'll happily sort of keep essentially as low a profile as possible. It's a little bit like, again, it's not a direct parallel, but the first day of the August coup, wherein you had a massive epidemic of police officers calling in sick because they didn't want to get involved in following the coup leader's orders, but nor did they want overtly to defy them.
Uh-huh.
They wanted to give themselves a bit of a breathing space just to see what happened. So I think basically there's a lot of people within the Siloviet community in Russia giving themselves that breathing space and seeing what happens in the next couple of months.
So metaphorically calling in sick until this thing shakes out.
Precisely.
How far along do you see this process, and do you see it getting much more sharper and acute over time?
It's not irreversible yet. I think the thing is that this current protest caught us, caught them, caught everyone by surprise. And therefore, I think there is an element of taking stock. And in this respect, precisely this holiday season has been fortuitous. You know, between holidays and low temperatures, it has actually meant that everything is quietening down. I think that the pendulum is beginning to swing back. There was a moment of panic. I think people are now beginning to accept that certainly Putin has at least one more term in him. And therefore, I think we're seeing the Siloviki beginning to sort of resume or their previous activities come February.
Now, sticking with the elite, I wrote recently on the blog that the true tandem is not Putin and Medvedev, but it's Putin and Alexei Kudrin, the former finance minister. And I would actually even push that a little bit farther and say the real tandem is the Siloviki on one hand, represented by Putin in that sense, and the technocratic elite, represented by Kudrin, and that there's a struggle going on between these two factions of the elite, and beyond that, within many factions within these factions, but between these two macro factions, you have a struggle about how much or whether at all political reform should take place. How do you see this aspect of it playing out, given what you just told me about what's going on within the Siloviki?
Well, this is it. I think there is this grudging awareness amongst the Siloviki that they need the technocrats. There is no sense that they can go without. I mean, in some ways, this whole conflict was obscured for a while precisely by Medvedev's weakness. I include myself amongst them, for a while saw Medvedev as the standard bearer of the technocrats. But on the other hand, you know, he clearly isn't. Someone like Kudrin is a very different candidate. I mean, as you pointed out, he's actually personally very close to Putin. And as well as having a set of goals which are, at least to a certain extent, compatible with Putin's, even if he clearly has a very different sense of how he wants to achieve them. So the interesting thing is that at the very top, you actually have the scope for far better cooperation between these two camps than you do further down the line. In the sense of Putin
and Kudrin yeah.
can work well, their camps less well. But I think this is it. I mean, I don't think that there's any question but that Putin, unless he goes mad and just becomes a thoroughly repressive czar, which I honestly don't believe is going to happen, he is going to need Kudrin. And that's why I think Kudrin is either immediately or quite quickly going to become prime minister once Putin wins the presidential elections. But more to the point, he's going to demand quite a high price for his services. He's not just simply going to be a yes man. He's not going to be a Medvedev. He's going to be someone who's willing to actually go nose to nose with Putin on issues that he thinks are important.
And who can go nose to nose with Putin due to his close personal relationship, and the guy carries some political weight.
Plus, of course, Putin is going to be a lot weaker after this presidential election than he's ever been in the past. And therefore, he's going to need Kudrin a lot more than he has in the past.
Now, Kudrin's been able to play this role inside of the elite, notwithstanding his conflicts with Sechin and other members of the Siloviki, because of his closeness to Putin, but also because of the fact that he's philosophically closer to the technocrats. He's kind of been able to be the man in the middle in the elite and play this kind of broker's role. He's now, if you see, he went to address the protesters on the 24th of December. He wasn't exactly well received, but he did go to address them, which would surprise me quite a bit. He seems to be trying to be the man in the middle between the elite and the protesters now. Do you see that as a viable role for Kudrin?
I do, so long as the protesters remain this relatively amorphous collection. It's going to be a lot harder if they actually ever begin to mobilize and, as it were, politically mechanize and form structures and so forth. Because at the moment, in a way, you have a large number of disgruntled yuppies. You have some protesters, leaders who are able to sort of capitalize on that, but don't, as it were, have strong political traction. And in a way, Kudrin then is offering them something. He's offering them a degree of in, a degree of access to the Kremlin that they would otherwise have no chance of getting. So as long as he's their only option, then I think he has hope of being able to do that. Because also, I mean, there's no question that, I mean, Kudrin is not positioning himself as an anti-Putin.
No.
He's positioning himself, as it were, as a member of the loyal opposition, the person who can actually go out from the Kremlin confines and talk to the masses and act as an intercessor rather than that he'd ever actually jump ship.
which is an unusual role for Kudrin. I've followed him since his days in the government in St. Petersburg in the late 80s and early in the 90s. And he's not a public politician. I mean, he's an extremely bright man. He's a top-flight economist, but he is not a public politician, and he seems to be wading into this role now. How do you think he's doing?
Well, I think he's in one... I mean, yes, he's not a natural populist.
To say the least.
Well, precisely. but on the other hand, in some ways, he benefits precisely from that fact. He doesn't pretend. He doesn't turn up in jeans and a leather jacket. He doesn't pretend to be anything than who he is. And therefore, he can aspire to having a certain role as being precisely the, here is a grown-up who's willing to come and talk to you. And I think actually that is the closest thing to a strength he's got in that kind of a context. But let's be honest, him dealing with the protest movement is a part and a small part of his overall political role and his overall sort of political strategy. We see it because it's obvious, and also it's precisely so sort of bizarre and unusual to see this figure who's more used to sort of hobnobbing with world bankers and finance ministers and out there. So obviously we concentrate on it. But in terms of, as it were, what kind of political importance we should give it, I think it's relatively minor. But it also says something about the impoverishment of Russian politics, is that who else has the Kremlin got who could possibly in any way represent some kind of a halfway credible interlocutor?
Well, Prokhorov is also, and Prokhorov and Kudrin are actually both kind of seem to be operating in sync on this.
In a way, Kudrin does not exactly have to worry where his next meal comes from, but at least he is not a multi-billionaire. It's even harder in some ways for Prokhorov to present himself as a man of the masses. But also, I think the whole business. I mean, the first political outing of Prokhorov's and how badly that was handled by everyone concerned, I think, has in some ways made it more problematic to use him as that. Right. You know, otherwise, yes, he could conceivably have been that bridge figure, but in the circumstances, Kudrin's pretty much all they've got.
Right. Well, yeah, his initial kind of political coming out gives us a good segue into the next thing I wanted to discuss, and that's Surkov. As you know, when the whole Prokhorov Right Cause project blew up, Prokhorov blamed Surkov for being the puppet master trying to control the political system. Surkov has now left his post as deputy Kremlin chief of staff, and more importantly, he's left his portfolio as the regime's chief ideologist and political manager to Vyacheslav Volodin, and he's going to join the government as the head of Medvedev's modernization project. What's going on with that, do you think? Is this the end of the Surkov era? Like, is this the architect of the political system.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit too soon to be writing his political obituaries yet. In part, in some ways, we're going back to the sort of point made right at the beginning that actually politics in Russia has never been about the formal structures and much more about the human relationships. Yes, it is significant that he's been moved. In part, again, it was a bone to throw to not just mass protesters, but probably also the Prokhorovs of the political system.
But it was also an indication in the eyes of some that the Kremlin was going to play hardball, because Volodin is much more of a hardball player than Surkov. Surkov operates with subterfuge and intrigue and diversion, and he's very good at that, where Volodin is more just, if you're in my way, I'm going to run you over. And so that was, it was an interesting duality when Surkov was removed, because on one hand, yes, he was reviled by the protesters, but on the other hand, he's being replaced by somebody that's going to be a much harder figure to deal with than a lot of...
Well, yes, two points I make. I mean, one is, on the other hand, Volodin is less closely linked with United Russia and more with the idea of that we can create this sort of, you know, broad popular movement. And so, you know, there is...
He was behind the People's Front.
Which, okay, that didn't work. But nonetheless, there is at least that sort of notion. But secondly, I do wonder if in part what this represents is actually a strategic decision being made about where the nexus for potential future discussion with society should be. That maybe it should not be with the presidency, but it actually should be with the prime ministership. That precisely the job of the prime minister is, as it were, to be the president's vicar on earth, the pope. And so in that respect, actually having him there within the prime ministerial structure also makes sense, Okay, I mean, there is in part, I think...
It goes to almost like the Yeltsin system, then, when the Prime Minister was extremely consequential because the President was largely absentee.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're going to quite have the same sort of system there. But I mean, I think precisely the sense that... I mean, we've had this bizarre situation under the strictures of the Tang democracy, in that, on the one hand, you had a President who constitutionally called the shots, but in fact you had a Prime Minister who was really the dominant figure. In some ways, we're actually shifting back to really how the political system was more intended to be, which is to once again have a president who is able to divine the broad structures of strategy, and a prime minister whose job is actually to be the engine master and make sure executed. In that respect, actually, it makes sense to have Surkov or a Surkov figure. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, again, you give him a portfolio like modernization, which is ideal, because what does it mean? It means nothing at all. It means a variety of little bits and pieces, most of which, frankly, are going to be handled by technocratic executors themselves, which leaves Surkov free to do what Surkov always does.
Which is what? The political intrigue?
Yeah.
So he just continues doing what he was always doing, just with a different hat.
Yeah, but it means, as it were, so Volodin is there in the presidential staff to be able to sort of paint a big picture narrative that is inclusive. Surkov is there doing the nuts and bolts within the prime ministerial staff, which is where you actually want the technocratic intriguer.
Now, those two are fierce rivals, adding to the interest, adding to the mix of this. I mean, a lot of people think that Volodin badly outmaneuvered Surkov, and this is why this happened. It's still unclear. It's, as the Russians call it, a battle under the carpet at this point. So it's.
I mean, I think it's certainly true that Surkov has actually lost. He has lost credit and points, precisely because all his smart-ass manoeuvring was precisely meant to ensure that this kind of a situation, this kind of a protest movement, didn't happen.
Yeah.
So in part, actually, the job is, right, well, you go out there and you fix this damn thing then.
Right. We're running low on time, but there's one more thing I did want to discuss. And you discussed earlier in the discussion the protest movement and the three prongs to it, right? The disgruntled yuppies, which make up the mass, the old guard opposition leaders like Nemtsov, and then the new generation, your Navalny's, your Chudikovas, and what have you. They don't have a leader right now. There isn't a real leader emerging. Do you see one emerging? Can Navalny emerge as a leader? Or if not Navalny, somebody else? Is there anybody that can emerge as the figure?
Well, it's difficult at the moment to think of it being anyone other than Navalny. But it's almost equally different to actually see it being Navalny. I mean, this is the problem. I mean, this is a man who we really know very little about. We know a lot of the things he's against. We have no real idea what he's for. Now, that need not be a problem. I mean, arguably, that was Boris Yeltsin's position.
Yes.
I mean, he was always the destroyer and the opposition rather than the creator with an image. But I don't think we're in that same situation. And more to the point, I don't see how many figures are going to be willing to subordinate themselves to Navalny or that they can politically do so. And as I said, we still come back to the basic unanswered question is, how do the protesters work with the communists? If they can't do that, then they're not getting anywhere. Then they're a glorious example of civil society. They may well be able to help provide the impulse for other wider changes, but if they really actually want to completely be able to rewrite the political system, they have to win elections, and for that they need a machine, and at the moment the communists are the only machine they can use.
But ideologically speaking, there's a chasm between where the communists are.
Precisely,
and,
I don't
and
see that happening. I mean, I think, you know, even if Zhuganov either had a stroke tomorrow or a massive political revelation and became a Berlinguer-style Euro-communist overnight or whatever, even if all that happened, there would just be still such a charge of mistrust. Left with the communists. They could not just reinvent themselves as cozy, comfy social democrats
right.
overnight.
As the protector of the new Russian middle class, that would be the irony of ironies, wouldn't it? Well, on that note, I think we should wrap it up here, Mark. It's been a fascinating discussion. I'd like to remind everybody you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog at RFERL. In the studio with me today was Mark Galeotti, professor of global politics at New York University and author of numerous books on Russia. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org. You can follow us on Twitter or you can visit our Facebook page. And now I will leave you with the music of my favorite socially conscious Russia rapper, Noize MC.